our society, and along which flow information and opinion carrying authority to the individual groups. Here are the conventions scheduled for Cleveland, Ohio, recorded in a single recent issue of World Convention Dates, a fraction of the 5,500 conventions and rallies scheduled. The Employing Photo Engravers Association of America, the Outdoor Writers Association, the Knights of St. John, the Walter League, the National Knitted Outerwear Association, the Knights of St. Joseph, the Royal Order of Sphinx, the Mortgage Bankers Association, the International Association of Public Employment Officials, the Kiwanis Clubs of Ohio, the American Photo Engravers Association, the Cleveland Auto Manufacturers Show, the American Society of Heating and Ventilating Engineers. Other conventions to be held in 1928 were those of the Association of Limb Manufacturers Association, the National Circus Fans Association of America, the American Naturopathic Association, the American Trap Shooting Association, the Texas Folklore Association, the Hotel Greeters, the Fox Breeders Association, the Insecticide and Disinfectant Association, the National Association of Egg Case and Egg Case Filler Manufacturers, the American Bottlers of Carbonated Beverages, and the National Pickle Packers Association, not to mention the Terrapin Derby, most of them with banquets and orations attached. If all these thousands of formal organizations and institutions could be listed, and no complete list has ever been made, they would still represent but a part of those existing less formally but leading vigorous lives. Ideas are sifted and opinions stereotyped in the neighborhood bridge club. Leaders assert their authority through community drives and amateur theatricals. Thousands of women may unconsciously belong to a sorority which follows the fashions set by a single society leader. Life satirically expresses this idea in the reply which it represents an American as giving to the Britisher, who praises this country for having no upper and lower classes or castes. "Yes, all we have is the 400, the white-collar men, bootleggers, Wall Street barons, criminals, the DAR, the KKK, the colonial dames, the Masons, Kiwanis, and Rotarians, the K of C, the Elks, the Censors, the Cognoscenti, the Morons, heroes like Lindy, the WCTU, politicians, Mencenites, the Boubois, immigrants, broadcasters, and the rich and poor." Yet it must be remembered that these thousands of groups interlace. John Jones, besides being a Rotarian, is member of a church, a fraternal order, of a political party, of a charitable organization, of a professional association, of a local chamber of commerce, of a league for or against prohibition, or of a society for or against lowering the tariff, or of a golf club. The opinions which he receives as a Rotarian, he will tend to disseminate in the other groups in which he may have influence. This invisible intertwining structure of groupings and associations is the mechanism by which democracy has organized its group mind and simplified its mass thinking. To deplore the existence of such a mechanism is to ask for a society such as never was and never will be. To admit that it exists, but expect that it shall not be used, is unreasonable. Emil Ludwig represents Napoleon as ever on the watch for indications of public opinion, always listening to the voice of the people, a voice which defies calculation. "Do you know," he said in those days, "what amazes me more than all else? The impotence of force to organize anything." It is the purpose of this book to explain the structure of the mechanism which controls the public mind, and to tell how it is manipulated by the special pleader who seeks to create public acceptance for a particular idea or commodity. It will attempt at the same time to find the due place in the modern democratic scheme for this new propaganda and to suggest its gradually evolving code of ethics and practice. Chapter 2. The New Propaganda. In the days when kings were kings, Louis XIV made his modest remark, "L'État, c'est moi." He was nearly right. But times have changed. The steam engine, the multiple press, and the public school, that trio of the Industrial Revolution, have taken the power away from kings and given it to the people. The people actually gained power which the king lost, for economic power tends to draw after it political power. And the history of the Industrial Revolution shows how that power passed from the king and the aristocracy to the bourgeoisie. Universal suffrage and universal schooling reinforced this tendency, and at last even the bourgeoisie stood in fear of the common people, for the masses promised to become king. Today, however, a reaction has set in. The minority has discovered a powerful help in influencing majorities. It has been found possible so to mold the mind of the masses that they will throw their newly gained strength in the desired direction. In the present structure of society, this practice is inevitable. Whatever of social importance is done today, whether in politics, finance, manufacture, agriculture, charity, education, or other fields, must be done with the help of propaganda. Propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government. Universal literacy was supposed to educate the common man to control his environment. Once he could read and write, he would have a mind fit to rule. So ran the democratic doctrine. But instead of a mind, universal literacy has given him rubber stamps. Rubber stamps inked with advertising slogans, with editorials, with published scientific data, with the trivialities of the tabloids and the platitudes of history, but quite innocent of original thought. Each man's rubber stamps are the duplicates of millions of others, so that when those millions are exposed to the same stimuli, all receive identical imprints. It may seem an exaggeration to say that the American public gets most of its ideas in this wholesale fashion. The mechanism by which ideas are disseminated on a large scale is propaganda, in the broad sense of an organized effort to spread a particular belief or doctrine. I am aware that the word propaganda carries to many minds an unpleasant connotation. Yet whether, in any instance, propaganda is good or bad depends upon the merit of the cause urged and the correctness of the information published. In itself, the word propaganda has certain technical meanings, which, like most things in this world, are neither good nor bad, but custom makes them so. I find the word defined in Funk and Wagnall's dictionary in four ways. 1. A society of cardinals, the overseers of foreign missions. Also, the College of Propaganda at Rome, founded by Pope Urban VIII in 1627 for education of missionary priests. Sacred College de Propaganda Fide. 2. Hence, any institution or scheme for propagating a doctrine or system. 3. Effort directed systematically toward the gaining of public support for an opinion or a course of action. 4. The principles advanced by a propaganda. The Scientific American, in a recent issue, pleads for the restoration to respectable usage of that fine old word, propaganda. There is no word in the English language, it says, whose meaning has been so sadly distorted as the word propaganda. The change took place mainly during the late war, when the term took on a decidedly sinister complexion. If you turn to the standard dictionary, you will find that the word was applied to a congregation or society of cardinals for the care and oversight of foreign missions, which was instituted at Rome in the year 1627. It was applied also to the College of the Propaganda at Rome that was founded by Pope Urban VIII for the education of the missionary priests. Hence, in later years, the word came to be applied to any institution or scheme for propagating a doctrine or system. Judged by this definition, we can see that in its true sense, propaganda is a perfectly legitimate form of human activity. Any society, whether it be social, religious, or political, which is possessed of certain beliefs and sets out to make them known either by the spoken or written words, is practicing propaganda. Truth is mighty and must prevail, and if any body of men believe that they have discovered a valuable truth, it is not merely their privilege but their duty to disseminate that truth. If they realize, as they quickly must, that this spreading of the truth can be done upon a large scale and effectively only by organized effort, they will make use of the press and the platform as the best means to give it wide circulation. Propaganda becomes vicious and reprehensive only when its authors consciously and deliberately disseminate what they know to be lies, or when they aim at effects which they know to be prejudicial to the common good. Propaganda, in its proper meaning, is a perfectly wholesome word of honest parentage and with an honorable history. The fact that it should today be carrying a sinister meaning merely shows how much of the child remains in the average adult. A group of citizens writes and talks in favor of a certain course of action in some debatable question, believing that it is promoting the best interest of the community. Propaganda? Not a bit of it. Just a plain, forceful statement of truth. But let another group of citizens express opposing views, and they are promptly labeled with the sinister name of propaganda. "What is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander," says a wise old proverb. Let us make haste to put this fine old word back where it belongs, and restore its dignified significance for the use of our children and our children's children. The extent to which propaganda shapes the progress of affairs about us may surprise even well-informed persons. Nevertheless, it is only necessary to look under the surface of the newspaper for a hint as to propaganda's authority over public opinion. Page 1 of the New York Times, on the day these paragraphs are written, contains 8 important news stories. 4 of them, or one half, are propaganda. The casual reader accepts them as accounts of spontaneous happenings. But are they? Here are the headlines which announce them. 12 nations warn China real reform must come before they give relief. Pritchett reports Zionism will fail. Realty men demand a transit inquiry. Our living standard highest in history, says Hoover report. Take them in order. The article on China explains the joint report of the Commission on Extraterritoriality in China, presenting an exposition of the powers stand in the Chinese muddle. What it says is less important than what it is. It was made public by the State Department today, with the purpose of presenting to the American public a picture of the State Department's position. Its source gives it authority, and the American public tends to accept and support the State Department view. The report of Dr. Pritchett, a trustee of the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace, is an attempt to find the facts about this Jewish colony in the midst of a restless Arab world. When Dr. Pritchett's survey convinced him that in the long run Zionism would bring more bitterness and more unhappiness, both for the Jew and for the Arab, this point of view was broadcast with all the authority of the Carnegie Foundation, so that the public would hear and believe. The statement by the president of the Real Estate Board of New York and Secretary Hoover's report are similar attempts to influence the public toward an opinion. These examples are not given to create the impression that there is anything sinister about propaganda. They are set down rather to illustrate how conscious direction is given to events, and how the men behind these events influence public opinion. As such, they are examples of modern propaganda. At this point, we may attempt to define propaganda. Modern propaganda is a consistent, enduring effort to create or shape events to influence the relations of the public to an enterprise, idea, or group. This practice of creating circumstances and of creating pictures in the minds of millions of persons is very common. Virtually no important undertaking is now carried on without it, whether the enterprise be building a cathedral, endowing a university, marketing a moving picture, floating a large bond issue, or electing a president. Sometimes the effect on the public is created by a professional propagandist, sometimes by an amateur deputed for the job. The important thing is that it is universal and continuous, and in its sum total it is regimenting the public mind every bit as much as an army regiments the bodies of its soldiers. So vast are the numbers of minds which can be regimented, and so tenacious are they when regimented, that a group at times offers an irresistible pressure before which legislators, editors, and teachers are helpless. The group will cling to its stereotypes, as Walter Lippmann calls it, making of those supposedly powerful beings, the leaders of public opinion, mere bits of driftwood in the surf. When an imperial wizard, sensing what is perhaps hunger for an ideal, offers a picture of a nation all Nordic and nationalistic, the common man of the older American stock, feeling himself elbowed out of his rightful position and prosperity by the newer immigrant stocks, grasps the picture which fits in so neatly with his prejudices and makes it his own. He buys the sheet and pillowcase costume and bands with his fellows by the thousand into a huge group, powerful enough to swing state elections and to throw a ponderous monkey wrench into a national convention. In our present social organization, approval of the public is essential to any large undertaking. Hence a laudable movement may be lost unless it impresses itself on the public mind. Charity, as well as business and politics and literature, for that matter, have had to adopt propaganda, for the public must be regimented into giving money just as it must be regimented into tuberculosis prophylaxis. The Near East Relief, the Association for the Improvement of the Condition of the Poor of New York, and all the rest, have to work on public opinion just as though they had tubes of toothpaste to sell. We are proud of our diminishing infant death rate, and that, too, is the work of propaganda. Propaganda does exist on all sides of us, and it does change our mental pictures of the world. Even if this be unduly pessimistic, and that remains to be proved, the opinion reflects a tendency that is undoubtedly real. In fact, its use is growing as its efficiency in gaining public support is recognized. This, then, evidently indicates the fact that anyone with sufficient influence can lead sections of the public at least for a time and for a given purpose. Formerly, the rulers were the leaders. They laid out the course of history by the simple process of doing what they wanted. And if nowadays the successors of the rulers, those whose position or ability gives them power, can no longer do what they want without the approval of the masses, they find in propaganda a tool which is increasingly powerful in gaining that approval. Therefore, propaganda is here to stay. It was, of course, the astounding success of propaganda during the war that opened the eyes of the intelligent few in all departments of life to the possibilities of regimenting the public mind. The American government and numerous patriotic agencies developed a technique which, to most persons accustomed to bidding for public acceptance, was new. They not only appealed to the individual by means of every approach, visual, graphic, and auditory, to support the national endeavor, but they also secured the cooperation of the key men in every group. Persons whose mere word carried authority to hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of followers. They thus automatically gained the support of fraternal, religious, commercial, patriotic, social, and local groups, whose members took their opinions from their accustomed leaders and spokesmen, or from the periodical publications which they were accustomed to read and believe. At the same time, the manipulators of patriotic opinion made use of the mental clichés and emotional habits of the public to produce mass reactions against the alleged atrocities, the terror, and the tyranny of the enemy. It was only natural, after the war ended, that intelligent persons should ask themselves whether it was possible to apply a similar technique to the problems of peace. As a matter of fact, the practice of propaganda since the war has assumed very different forms from those prevalent 20 years ago. This new technique may fairly be called the new propaganda. It takes account not merely of the individual, nor even of the mass mind alone, but also and especially of the anatomy of society, with its interlocking group formations and loyalties. It sees the individual not only as a cell in the social organism, but as a cell organized into the social unit. Touch a nerve at a sensitive spot, and you get an automatic response from certain specific members of the organism. Business offers graphic examples of the effect that may be produced upon the public by interested groups, such as textile manufacturers losing their markets. This problem arose not long ago when the velvet manufacturers were facing ruin because their product had long been out of fashion. Analysis showed that it was impossible to revive a velvet fashion within America. Anatomical hunt for the vital spot. Paris, obviously. But yes and no. Paris is the home of fashion. Lyon is the home of silk. The attack had to be made at the source. It was determined to substitute purpose for chance, and to utilize the regular sources for fashion distribution and to influence the public from these sources. A velvet fashion service, openly supported by the manufacturers, was organized. Its first function was to establish contact with the Lyon manufactories and the Paris couturiers to discover what they were doing, to encourage them to act on behalf of velvet, and to help in the proper exploitation of their wares. An intelligent Parisian was enlisted in the work. He visited Lanvin and Worth, Agnès and Patou and others, and induced them to use velvet in their gowns and hats. It was he who arranged for the distinguished countess this or duchess that to wear the hat or the gown. And as for the presentation of the idea to the public, the American buyer or the American woman of fashion was simply shown the velvet creations in the atelier of the dressmaker or the milliner. She bought the velvet because she liked it and because it was in fashion. The editors of the American magazines and fashion reporters of the American newspapers likewise subjected to the actual, although created, circumstance, reflected it in their news, which in turn subjected the buyer and the consumer here to the same influences. The result was that what was at first a trickle of velvet became a flood. A demand was slowly but deliberately created in Paris and America. A big department store, aiming to be a style leader, advertised velvet gowns and hats on the authority of the French couturier, and quoted original cables received from them. The echo of the new style was heard from hundreds of department stores throughout the country, which wanted to be style leaders too. Bulletins followed dispatches, the mail followed the cables, and the American woman traveler appeared before the ship news photographers in velvet gown and hat. The created circumstances had their effect. "Fickle fashion has veered to velvet," was one newspaper comment, and the industry in the United States again kept thousands busy. The new propaganda, having regard to the constitution of society as a whole, not infrequently serves to focus and realize the desires of the masses. A desire for a specific reform, however widespread, cannot be translated into action until it is made articulate, and until it has exerted sufficient pressure upon the proper lawmaking bodies. Millions of housewives may feel that manufactured foods deleterious to health should be prohibited, but there is little chance that their individual desires will be translated into effective legal form unless their half-expressed demand can be organized, made vocal, and concentrated upon the state legislature or upon the federal Congress, in some mode which will produce the results they desire. Whether they realize it or not, they call upon propaganda to organize and effectuate their demand. But clearly it is the intelligent minorities which need to make use of propaganda continuously and systematically. In the active proselytizing minorities in whom selfish interests and public interests coincide lie the progress and development of America. Only through the active energy of the intelligent few can the public at large become aware of and act upon new ideas. Small groups of persons can and do make the rest of us think what they please about a given subject, but there are usually proponents and opponents of every propaganda, both of whom are equally eager to convince the majority. Chapter 3. The New Propagandists. Who are the men who, without our realizing it, give us our ideas, tell us whom to admire and whom to despise, what to believe about the ownership of public utilities, about the tariff, about the price of rubber, about the Dawes Plan, about immigration? Who tell us how our houses should be designed, what furniture we should put into them, what menus we should serve at our table, what kind of shirts we must wear, what sports we should indulge in, what plays we should see, what charities we should support, what pictures we should admire, what slang we should affect, what jokes we should laugh at? If we set out to make a list of the men and women who, because of their position in public life, might fairly be called the molders of public opinion, we could quickly arrive at an extended list of persons mentioned in Who's Who. It would obviously include the President of the United States and the members of his cabinet, the senators and representatives in Congress, the governors of the 48 states, the presidents of the chambers of commerce in our 100 largest cities, the chairman of the boards of directors of our 100 or more largest industrial corporations, the president of many of the labor unions affiliated in the American Federation of Labor, the national president of each of the national professional and fraternal organizations, the president of each of the racial and language societies in the country, the 100 leading newspaper and magazine editors, the 50 most popular authors, the presidents of the 50 leading charitable organizations, the 20 leading theatrical or cinema producers, the 100 recognized leaders of fashion, the most popular and influential clergymen in the 100 leading cities, the presidents of our colleges and universities, and the foremost members of their faculties, the most powerful financiers in Wall Street, the most noted amateurs of sports, and so on. Such a list would comprise several thousand persons, but it is well known that many of these leaders are themselves led, sometimes by persons whose names are known to few. Many a congressman, in framing his platform, follows the suggestions of a district boss whom few persons outside the political machines have ever heard of. Eloquent divines may have great influence in their communities, but often take their doctrines from a higher ecclesiastical authority. The presidents of chambers of commerce mold the thought of local businessmen concerning public issues, but the opinions which they promulgate are usually derived from some national authority. A presidential candidate may be drafted in response to overwhelming popular demand, but it is well known that his name may be decided upon by half a dozen men sitting around a table in a hotel room. In some instances, the power of invisible wire pullers is flagrant. The power of the invisible cabinet which deliberated at the poker table in a certain little greenhouse in Washington has become a national legend. There was a period in which the major policies of the national government were dictated by a single man, Mark Hanna. A Simmons may, for a few years, succeed in marshaling millions of men on a platform of intolerance and violence. Such persons typify in the public mind the type of ruler associated with the phrase invisible government. But we do not often stop to think that there are dictators in other fields whose influence is just as decisive as that of the politicians I have mentioned. As Irene Castle can establish the fashion of short hair which dominates 9/10 of the women who make any pretense to being fashionable. Paris fashion leaders set the mode of the short skirt, for wearing which, 20 years ago, any woman would simply have been arrested and thrown into jail by the New York City police. And the entire women's clothing industry, capitalized at hundreds of millions of dollars, must be reorganized to conform to their dictum. There are invisible rulers who control the destinies of millions. It is not generally realized to what extent the words and actions of our most influential public men are dictated by shrewd persons operating behind the scenes. Now, what is still more important, the extent to which our thoughts and habits are modified by authorities. In some departments of our daily life in which we imagine ourselves free agents, we are ruled by dictators exercising great power. A man buying a suit of clothes imagines that he is choosing, according to his taste and his personality, the kind of garment which he prefers. In reality, he may be obeying the orders of an anonymous gentleman tailor in London. This personage is the silent partner in a modest tailoring establishment, which is patronized by gentlemen of fashion and princes of blood. He suggests to British noblemen and others a blue cloth instead of gray, 2 buttons instead of 3, or sleeves 1/4 inch narrower than last season. The distinguished customer approves of the idea. But how does this fact affect John Smith of Topeka? The gentleman tailor is under contract with a certain large American firm, which manufactures men's suits, to send them instantly the designs of the suits chosen by the leaders of London fashion. Upon receiving the designs, with specifications as to color, weight, and texture, the firm immediately places an order with the cloth makers for several $100,000 worth of cloth. The suits made up according to the specifications are then advertised as the latest fashion. The fashionable men in New York, Chicago, Boston, and Philadelphia wear them, and the Topeka man, recognizing this leadership, does the same. Women are just as subject to the commands of invisible government as men. A silk manufacturer, seeking a new market for its product, suggested to a large manufacturer of shoes that women's shoes should be covered with silk to match their dresses. The idea was adopted and systematically propagandized. A popular actress was persuaded to wear the shoes. The fashion spread. The shoe firm was ready with the supply to meet the created demand, and the silk company was ready with the silk for more shoes. The man who injected this idea into the shoe industry was ruling women in one department of their social lives. Different men rule us in the various departments of our lives. There may be one power behind the throne in politics, another in the manipulations of the federal discount rate, and still another in the dictation of next season's dances. If there were a national invisible cabinet ruling our destinies, a thing which is not impossible to conceive of, it would work through certain group leaders on Tuesday for one purpose and through an entirely different set on Wednesday for another. The idea of invisible government is relative. There may be a handful of men who control the educational methods of the great majority of our schools. Yet, from another standpoint, every parent is a group leader with authority over his or her children. The invisible government tends to be concentrated in the hands of the few because of the expense of manipulating the social machinery which controls the opinions and habits of the masses. To advertise on a scale which will reach 50 million persons is expensive. To reach and persuade the group leaders who dictate the public's thoughts and actions is likewise expensive. For this reason, there is an increasing tendency to concentrate the functions of propaganda in the hands of the propaganda specialist. This specialist is more and more assuming a distinct place and function in our natural life. New activities call for new nomenclature. The propagandist who specializes in interpreting enterprises and ideas to the public, and in interpreting the public to promulgators of new enterprises and ideas, has come to be known by the name of Public Relations Council. The new profession of public relations has grown up because of the increasing complexity of modern life and the consequent necessity for making the actions of one part of the public understandable to other sectors of the public. It is due, too, to the increasing dependence of organized power of all sorts upon public opinion. Governments, whether they are monarchical, constitutional, democratic, or communist, depend upon acquiescent public opinion for the success of their efforts. And, in fact, government is government only by virtue of public acquiescence. Industries, public utilities, educational movements, indeed all groups representing any concept or product, whether they are majority or minority ideas, succeed only because of approving public opinion. Public opinion is the unacknowledged partner in all broad efforts. The Public Relations Council, then, is the agent who, working with modern media of communications and the group formations of society, brings an idea to the consciousness of the public. But he is a great deal more than that. He is concerned with courses of action, doctrines, systems and opinions, and the securing of public support for them. He is also concerned with tangible things, such as manufactured and raw products. He is concerned with public utilities, with large trade groups, and associations representing entire industries. He functions primarily as an advisor to his client, very much as a lawyer does. A lawyer concentrates on the legal aspects of his client's business. A counsel on public relations concentrates on the public contacts of his client's business. Every phase of his client's ideas, products, or activities which may affect the public or in which the public may have an interest, is part of his function. For instance, in the specific problems of the manufacturer, he examines the product, the markets, the way in which the public reacts to the product, the attitude of the employees to the public and towards the product, and the cooperation of the distribution agencies. The Council on Public Relations, after he has examined all these and other factors, endeavors to shape the actions of his clients so that they will gain the interest, the approval, and the acceptance of the public. The means by which the public is apprised of the actions of his client are as varied as the means of communication themselves, such as conversation, letters, the stage, the motion picture, the radio, the lecture platform, the magazine, the daily newspaper. The Council on Public Relations is not an advertising man, but he advocates advertising where that is indicated. Very often he is called in by an advertising agency to supplement its work on behalf of a client. His work and that of the advertising agency do not conflict with or duplicate each other. His first efforts are naturally devoted to analyzing his client's problems and making sure that what he has to offer the public is something which the public accepts or can be brought to accept. It is futile to attempt to sell an idea or to prepare the ground for a product that is basically unsound. For example, an orphan asylum is worried by a falling off in contributions and a puzzling attitude of indifference or hostility on the part of the public. The Council on Public Relations may discover upon analysis that the public, alive to modern sociological trends, subconsciously criticizes the institution because it is not organized on the new cottage plan. He will advise modification of the client in this respect. Or a railroad may be urged to put on a fast train for the sake of the prestige which it will lend to the road's name, and hence to its stocks and bonds. If the corset makers, for instance, wished to bring the product into fashion again, he would unquestionably advise that the plan was impossible, since women have definitely emancipated themselves from the old-style corset. Yet his fashion advisers might report that women might be persuaded to adopt a certain type of girdle, which eliminated the unhealthful features of the corset. His next effort is to analyze his public. He studies the groups which must be reached and the leaders through whom he may approach these groups. Social groups, economic groups, geographical groups, age groups, doctrinal groups, language groups, cultural groups, all these represent his divisions through which, on behalf of his client, he may talk to the public. Only after this double analysis has been made and the results collated has the time come for the next step, the formulation of policies governing the general practice, procedure, and habits of the client in all those aspects in which he comes in contact with the public. And only when these policies have been agreed upon is it time for the fourth step. The first recognition of the distinct functions of the Public Relations Council arose, perhaps, in the early years of the present century, as a result of the insurance scandals coincident with the muckraking of corporate finance in the popular magazines. The interests thus attacked suddenly realized that they were completely out of touch with the public they were professing to serve, and required expert advice to show them how they could understand the public and interpret themselves to it. The Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, prompted by the most fundamental self-interest, initiated a conscious, directed effort to change the attitude of the public toward insurance companies in general, and toward itself in particular, to its profit and the public's benefit. It tried to make a majority movement of itself by getting the public to buy its policies. It reached the public at every point of its corporate and separate existences. To communities, it gave health surveys and expert counsel. To individuals, it gave health creeds and advice. Even the building in which the corporation was located was made a picturesque landmark to see and remember. In other words, to carry on the associative process. And so this company came to have a broad general acceptance. The number and amount of its policies grew constantly as its broad contacts with society increased. Within a decade, many large corporations were employing public relations counsel under one title or another, for they had come to recognize that they depended upon public goodwill for their continued prosperity. It was no longer true that it was none of the public's business how the affairs of a corporation were managed. They were obliged to convince the public that they were conforming to its demands as to honesty and fairness. Thus, a corporation might discover that its labor policy was causing public resentment, and might introduce a more enlightened policy solely for the sake of general goodwill. Or a department store hunting for the cause of diminishing sales might discover that its clerks had a reputation for bad manners and initiate formal instruction in courtesy and tact. The public relations expert may be known as public relations director or counsel. Often he is called secretary or vice president or director. Sometimes he is known as cabinet officer or commissioner. By whatever title he may be called, his function is well defined and his advice has definite bearing on the conduct of the group or individual with whom he is working. Many persons still believe that the Public Relations Council is a propagandist and nothing else. But on the contrary, the stage at which many suppose he starts his activities may actually be the stage at which he ends them. After the public and the client are thoroughly analyzed and policies have been formulated, his work may be finished. In other cases, the work of the Public Relations Council must be continuous to be effective. For in many instances, only by a careful system of constant, thorough, and frank information will the public understand and appreciate the value of what a merchant, educator, or statesman is doing. The Council on Public Relations must maintain constant vigilance, because inadequate information or false information from unknown sources may have results of enormous importance. A single false rumor at a critical moment may drive down the price of a corporation's stock, causing a loss of millions to stockholders. An air of secrecy or mystery about a corporation's financial dealings may breed a general suspicion capable of acting as an invisible drag on the company's whole dealings with the public. The Council on Public Relations must be in a position to deal effectively with rumors and suspicions, attempting to stop them at their source, counteracting them promptly with correct or more complete information through channels which will be most effective, or best of all, establish such relationships of confidence in the concern's integrity that rumors and suspicions will have no opportunity to take root. His function may include the discovery of new markets, the existence of which had been unsuspected. If we accept public relations as a profession, we must also expect it to have ideals and ethics. The idea of the profession is a pragmatic one. It is to make the producer, whether that producer be a legislature making laws or a manufacturer making a commercial product, understand what the public wants, and to make the public understand the objectives of the producer. In relation to industry, the ideal of the profession is to eliminate the waste and the friction that result when industry does things or makes things which its public does not want, or when the public does not understand what is being offered it. For example, the telephone companies maintain extensive public relations departments to explain what they are doing, so that energy may not be burned up in the friction of misunderstanding. A detailed description, for example, of the immense and scientific care which the company takes to choose clearly understandable and distinguishable exchange names helps the public to appreciate the effort that is being made to give good service, and stimulates it to cooperate by enunciating clearly. It aims to bring about an understanding between educators and educated, between government and people, between charitable institutions and contributors, between nation and nation. The profession of Public Relations Council is developing for itself an ethical code which compares favorably with that governing the legal and medical professions. In part, this code is forced upon the Public Relations Council by the very conditions of his work. While recognizing, just as the lawyer does, that everyone has the right to present his case in its best light, he nevertheless refuses a client whom he believes to be dishonest, a product which he believes to be fraudulent, or a cause which he believes to be antisocial. One reason for this is that even though a special pleader, he is not dissociated from the client in the public's mind. Another reason is that while he is pleading before the court of public opinion, he is at the same time trying to affect that court's judgments and actions. In law, the judge and jury hold the deciding balance of power. In public opinion, the Public Relations Council is judge and jury because through his pleading of a case, the public may exceed his opinion and judgment. He does not accept a client whose interests conflict with those of another client. He does not accept a client whose case he believes to be hopeless or whose product he believes to be unmarketable. He should be candid in his dealings. It must be repeated that his business is not to fool or hoodwink the public. If he were to get such a reputation, his usefulness in his profession would be at an end. When he is sending out propaganda material, it is clearly labeled as to source. The editor knows from whom it comes and what its purpose is, and accepts or rejects it on its merits as news. Chapter 4. The Psychology of Public Relations. The systematic study of mass psychology revealed to students the potentialities of invisible government of society by manipulation of the motives which actuate man in the group. Trotter and Le Bon, who approached the subject in a scientific manner, and Graham Wallace, Walter Lippmann, and others who continued with searching studies of the group mind, established that the group has mental characteristics distinct from those of the individual, and is motivated by impulses and emotions which cannot be explained on the basis of what we know of individual psychology. So the question naturally arose, if we understand the mechanism and motives of the group mind, is it not possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without their knowing about it? The recent practice of propaganda has proved that it is possible, at least up to a certain point and within certain limits. Mass psychology is as yet far from being an exact science, and the mysteries of human motivation are by no means all revealed. But at least theory and practice have combined with sufficient success to permit us to know that in certain cases we can effect some change in public opinion with a fair degree of accuracy by operating a certain mechanism, just as the motorist can regulate the speed of his car by manipulating the flow of gasoline. Propaganda is not a science in the laboratory sense, but it is no longer entirely the empirical affair that it was before the advent of the study of mass psychology. It is now scientific in the sense that it seeks to base its operations upon definite knowledge drawn from direct observation of the group mind, and upon the application of principles which have been demonstrated to be consistent and relatively constant. The modern propagandist studies systematically and objectively the material with which he is working in the spirit of the laboratory. If the matter in hand is a nationwide sales campaign, he studies the field by means of a clipping service, or of a corps of scouts, or by personal study at a crucial spot. He determines, for example, which features of a product are losing their public appeal, and in what new direction the public taste is veering. He will not fail to investigate to what extent it is the wife who has the final word in the choice of her husband's car, or of his suits and shirts. Scientific accuracy of results is not to be expected, because many of the elements of the situation must always be beyond his control. He may know with a fair degree of certainty that under favorable circumstances an international flight will produce a spirit of goodwill, making possible even the consummation of political programs. But he cannot be sure that some unexpected event will not overshadow this flight in the public interest, or that some other aviator may not do something more spectacular the day before. Even in his restricted field of public psychology, there must always be a wide margin of error. Propaganda, like economics and sociology, can never be an exact science, for the reason that its subject matter, like theirs, deals with human beings. If you can influence the leaders, either with or without their conscious cooperation, you automatically influence the group which they sway. But men do not need to be actually gathered together in a public meeting or in a street riot to be subject to the influences of mass psychology. Because man is by nature gregarious, he feels himself to be a member of a herd, even when he is alone in his room with the curtains drawn. His mind retains the patterns which have been stamped on it by the group influences. A man sits in his office deciding what stocks to buy. He imagines, no doubt, that he is planning his purchases according to his own judgment. In actual fact, his judgment is a mélange of impressions stamped on his mind by outside influences which unconsciously control his thought. He buys a certain railroad stock because it was in the headlines yesterday, and hence it is the one which comes most prominently to his mind, because he has a pleasant recollection of a good dinner on one of its fast trains, because it has a liberal labor policy, a reputation for honesty, because he has been told that J.P. Morgan owns some of its shares. Trotter and Le Bon concluded that the group mind does not think, in the strict sense of the word. In place of thoughts, it has impulses, habits, and emotions. In making up its mind, its first impulse is usually to follow the example of a trusted leader. This is one of the most firmly established principles of mass psychology. It operates in establishing the rising or diminishing prestige of a summer resort, in causing a run on a bank or a panic on the stock exchange, in creating a bestseller or a box office success. But when the example of the leader is not at hand and the herd must think for itself, it does so by means of clichés, pat words, or images which stand for a whole group of ideas or experiences. Not many years ago, it was only necessary to tag a political candidate with the word interests to stampede millions of people into voting against him, because anything associated with the interests seemed necessarily corrupt. Recently, the word Bolshevik has performed a similar service for persons who wished to frighten the public away from a line of action. By playing upon an old cliché or manipulating a new one, the propagandist can sometimes swing a whole mass of group emotions. In Great Britain during the war, the evacuation hospitals came in for a considerable amount of criticism because of the summary way in which they handled their wounded. It was assumed by the public that a hospital gives prolonged and conscientious attention to its patients. When the name was changed to evacuation posts, the critical reaction vanished. No one expected more than an adequate emergency treatment from an institution so named. The cliché hospital was indelibly associated in the public mind with a certain picture. To persuade the public to discriminate between one type of hospital and another, to dissociate the cliché from the picture it evoked, would have been an impossible task. Instead, a new cliché automatically conditioned the public emotion toward these hospitals. Men are rarely aware of the real reasons which motivate their actions.